Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have a problem with these thoughts, FYP. Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 113 of Registry Matters. Larry, Saturday night, here we are again. And look, my clock says 7:01 p.m. What time does your clock say?
It says 5:03.
5:03. We have super duper awesome special guest. Welcome back, Ashley. How are you this evening?
I'm doing wonderful. How are you guys doing?
Awesome, awesome. Thank you for coming back.
Thanks for having me again. It's an exciting week.
How did Larry entice you to come back?
I begged him to come back, right, Larry?
Wow.
I wouldn't recollect it being exactly that.
So what do we have going on tonight? We have some big decisions. We have a bunch of news articles. We have a remembrance to highlight what also happened like in some southern states. Where do you want to start, Larry?
Well, it's a tough agenda. I think we could touch on the decision out of Illinois, which is we have such sketchy information. It's only to say that we have a decision that we weren't excited about regarding the Wayside Cross Ministry. There was an injunction sought after, and apparently the state court judge in Illinois denied the request for injunctive relief. So those men are going to have to leave the shelter there that's been there. I think I talked to our communications director today, and I think she said that the thing has been in existence for like 100 years, and their particular program that those men are in has been in existence for like 50 years.
And this is on the, we covered this topic, I don't remember which episode, how far back it was, just a handful of weeks. So a park was set up semi-ish nearby, and then they said they had 30 days to get out. I think
That's what I remember, but it's so sketchy. The link doesn't take us to a decision. I texted one of the attorneys and asked if she could send it, and I haven't gotten it back yet. So it's certainly not an deep dive, but what we can always say with injunctive relief is it's very difficult to obtain injunctive relief because this is even stumps our communications director. If you have the status quo and you're seeking to preserve the status quo, you have to show that irreparable harm will result and that you're likely to prevail on the merits when the case goes to trial because the court is ruling in advance of the case being tested for sufficiency. So therefore, the expectations of what you show are very high. And since the case hasn't been tried, the defenses that will be asserted at trial are presumed valid. And that really discombobulates everybody. You know, it's like, well, whatever they're saying now is presumed true. It's kind of like the standard in summary judgment when people say, well, the decision in the Supreme Court, Smith versus Doe, clearly the recidivism was not astronomically high and frightening, but those were facts that were determined in summary judgment because the assertions that were made in the motion for summary judgment, the non-moving party that didn't want the summary judgment is entitled to have everything that party would have put forth as a defense presumed true. Well, a similar standard exists in injunctive relief. We haven't had a chance to put on our full case. So therefore, we tell the court what we would allege as our defense if the case were being tried right now. And the court presumes that untested defense is true.
Well, what status? These are people that are on supervision, or is there a combination of both? I'm wondering about the public interest, the public safety interest. Where are these men being afforded any due process as far as assuming that they're dangerous to child safety?
I'm not sure it's clear what the status of the 18 are, whether any of them on supervision or not. I don't believe it will make a dramatic difference in the analysis because the law, I don't think, delineates between supervised and unsupervised. It's that anybody on the registry can't be there. So I don't think that would be material to the determination.
Okay. I mean, it seems reasonable to, I could see arguing both sides that the person did the crime. That doesn't mean they're necessarily going to do another crime, but I could see that getting argued both ways. You've obviously shown that you are capable of doing the crime. therefore you have a higher propensity to commit a crime similar. I could see it going both ways.
But that wasn't the basis of the statute. The statute doesn't say that you're forbidden to live within 500 feet if you have a propensity to commit a crime. It says you're not forbidden. You're not permitted. You're forbidden to live there, period.
Right.
So the court's not analyzing whether or not whether you have a propensity to commit a crime. That's not what it's analyzing. The court's analyzing whether or not you can have a statute that's constitutional that limits the zone of where a person can live. Whether or not that's sound public policy is not for the court to decide.
Right. But there are other places where they have ruled those kinds of restrictions unconstitutional.
There has been, but this judge at this, like I say, this is a local judge. This is not a federal judge. And this is also confusing because apparently they filed a federal lawsuit, but the federal court has required them to go through this exercise with the state court to see where they get before they move to the next level of federal. So this is a big, great thing to have Adele and Mark and to talk about on a future episode, which I'm working on right now. But
totally understand.
There's so much we don't know about this, but an injunction is very difficult to get. And that's why when one is achieved, we just celebrate so much because it's an almost insurmountable task to get injunctive relief.
Which is what we achieved in the Georgia thing with the Halloween signs. Well, all right then. So, and that came from the Daily Herald is where that first article came from. And since we have our super duper awesome former prosecutor Ashley on, we do have an article where we're talking about prosecutorial misconduct. Here we have from Law.com and the New York Law Journal that I know we talked about this 3-ish months ago where we brought it up, that there was going to be an independent panel brought up to go through and audit the prosecutors across New York. And obviously there was pushback from the prosecutors and the judge struck it down. I'm still baffled. If you guys, not you, I'm not saying you, if those guys and gals are so, they're like, we want justice, why wouldn't they want to be, to some degree, they would want to have their own selves be impartial, evaluated for their integrity and all that? I'm just baffled by that concept.
So I think what we're running into is the same issue that's raised whenever we do a law enforcement oversight committee on like law enforcement shootings and things like that. Because the fear is by prosecutors is the people on those types of commissions do not understand all the facts in a decision on whether to prosecute something, not prosecute something. It isn't just prosecutorial misconduct. What they're also worried about is that the watchdog group might say, oh, you didn't prosecute enough of these, but then you prosecuted too many of these when there could be a million factors. So I think that plays a lot into it whenever you're talking about a watchdog type of commission.
So and are you saying just, you know, car theft versus just whatever, you're just talking about the whole batch? So a prosecutor could have, you know, a wild hair that he just wants to prosecute burglaries and doesn't care about carjacking? Are you thinking something like that too?
Well, a little bit. In certain communities, because of public outcry, there's going to be certain focuses on crime. We know this. We know the hysteria that inflames types of prosecutions. So they may focus on that because the public demands it, and then not give as much weight to shopliftings and things like that. And then if they get questioned on that, then they're going to have to backtrack and say, well, it's because the public demands. And then they're going to be told, well, no, you're supposed to do your job regardless, and it's just going to turn into a big old thing. I think that feeds some of the fear. The other fear is lawyers by nature don't like to be watched. I mean, I think there's some of that going on too.
I see. Larry, what do you have?
It's hard for me to have much more to add on to that. I do believe that they do have some legitimate fears, depending on how the watchdog, what they're actually watching for. Prosecutorial decisions are tough to make in terms of evidence and whether you have a strong case or not. A sensational case doesn't necessarily translate to a strong case, nor does an egregious case necessarily translate to a strong case from a prosecutor's point of view, which means I would understand their concern about if we're going to go back and second guess their actual decisions on what to prosecute and what not to prosecute. But when they've made a decision of what to prosecute, when there's questions about whether they withheld evidence, whether they violated Brady, whether it's unethical conduct, if we can narrow down the scope of the oversight, I think that fear should be it would be misplaced It seems like to me, if you're an ethical prosecutor, and Alex Honner and Peter Hostrom and Boulder very much both were, you would want to not have unethical people amongst you. The same thing I say about police officers. If 99.8725% of you are good and solid and moral, why would you want that small fraction around in the club? You would want them out, I would think.
And I totally agree with that, but I think that there are other ways to do it short of a commission. And I'm with you. We don't know exactly what the structure would be on the commission, if it's actually questioning the decisions they make or providing some guidance in the decisions they should be making or how they actually prosecute crimes. We don't know. We don't know enough about it. But you can file a complaint with the bar. You can allege malicious prosecution. There's ethical considerations. And the judicial bench actually goes after unethical prosecutors in some of the jurisdictions as well. So I think there are alternative methods to doing it this way. And I would kind of need to know more about what their structure and their intent was.
I have an idea. So to make the analogy, why don't we have registrants monitor registrants to make sure that they're being compliant with the rules?
Come again?
If we had the registrants monitoring the registrants, then I'm pretty sure that we would allow each other to curry favor with each other. Like, hey, you can go to this website. Hey, that's fine. Hey, I get to go to my favorite website.
He's making a point that the attorneys monitoring themselves may not be the most effective way to do that because self-monitoring. But you know, I tell people I can't speak for other states, but there's one state I can speak for. And that's our chief disciplinary counsel, Mr. Slee, is here in this state. I can tell you this. I haven't met a more honorable man than in terms of holding lawyers' feet to the fire. If you get crossways with Mr. Slee about something that's unethical, you're likely to pay with a significant sanction or even possibly losing your license. So here, they take misconduct very seriously, both in terms of handling client funds and in terms of how a lawyer ethically represents their clients and when they violate the rules of professional conduct. You can get anything from a letter of caution to a formal reprimand to a suspension to an outright disbarment. And I think, Ashley, you could say you've seen them all, including a recent friend of yours.
Yes, I have. I've seen it all the way across the board. So they do. And the good thing about, I don't know how other states handle it, but here in New Mexico, you can give the ethics office a call and say, hey, look, I have this issue. Can you advise me? And they'll advise you. They won't, oh, that's unethical. They won't act that way. They'll be like, well, here's how you should handle it. And they'll do that all day long. Everybody over there will. So I think that we have a really good system in place here. But like Larry said, we can't speak for other states.
Well, but the point he's making is that it's the prosecutors are monitoring themselves, and any complaint is going to the judges or to the lawyers. But that we have a lot of professions that self monitor. You know, we do that in medicine. I mean, we do that in a number of professions where there's boards of discipline that takes it. The theory, I think, Andy, is that the expertise required to know whether something's crossed the line. The rules of professional conduct, some are very simple, some are pretty complicated in terms of what you can't do. I find myself sitting down. We just sent some letters to prisons in New Mexico, and I kind of jumped the gun without consulting with Ashley. And I said, Ashley, I hope I haven't broken the rules of professional conduct here in terms of, because this is kind of a lawyer solicitation. And we stamped it as attorney-client confidential. There's a rule on that.
Right.
And you can't do that. You can't do that. But as you said, we were fine.
I would also make the comparison to like the scientific community, where they put forth their paper and then they let their peers go beat on it to prove whether it's valid or not. Not this doesn't necessarily work the exact same way. We can move on. But it seems that maybe you would have another state who has a similar process evaluate, you know, state A versus state B, just to have some level of oversight, because the fox watching the hen house does seem to be a bad idea, like always.
I can understand that.
Well, do you guys want to cover this tragedy out of New Mexico that is literally 40 years old tonight?
We do, Andy.
So this is, I think you've reported, Larry, you said that this was the worst death riot in U.S. prison history. I think something along those lines.
It remains to be the deadliest prison riot in U.S. history to this very day. It eclipsed the I think Attica held the record, and I believe Attica was in 71. That's a New York prison, and this eclipsed Attica. And to this day, I don't think anything comes close to. I mean, Mississippi and Alabama, they're competing to see if they can match it, but right now, I think this is the deadliest. Still remains the deadliest riot in U.S. history.
And that was 33 people. Is that right?
33 inmates on this very weekend of 1980. The one and only penitentiary of New Mexico went into a full-fledged riot, 2 o'clock in the morning, 1:30, 2 o'clock in the morning. The inmates, took control with relatively ease. I mean, it's a long story, a long read in the Albuquerque Journal, the link that we've put on there, but it was with relatively ease. There was a skeleton crew on duty at the prison, very young guard that was in a key position that had left a door, a grill open. And they overpowered him quickly, and they took control of the various sections of the prison. Then one housing unit was down for major renovation where the maximum security would have been, and they had to blend those people into the lower security facilities because we only had one penitentiary in those days. So there was a lot of work equipment, torches, saws, all sorts of tools that were in the prison, and they were able to take control of that stuff, but we ended up with 33.
And I know we're going to tie it together to the recent Mississippi situation. Do you think that there's a parallel between the conditions then versus the conditions in Mississippi that brought up the situation a couple weeks back?
There's absolutely a parallel, and it's so disingenuous for the governor of Mississippi to blame the situation on cell phones.
I have a clip of that when we get to it. It kind of cracks me up.
The situation in Mississippi is very comparable. Lack of funding. Lack of professional staff, lack of programming, degraded facilities, outdated facilities, and the same thing that he minimizes it and tries to cast a problem on gangs in prison. Yes, there are gangs in prisons, the Mississippi prisons, and every prison system there's gang activity, but the cell phones are largely a reaction to the exploitation of the overcharging for phone calls, and you can end up paying $10, $12, $15 for a 30-minute, 15, actually, I think 30 minutes would be on the long side, but for a 10 to 15-minute phone call. And the cell phones are cheaper because the lowly paid guards will smuggle in the cell phones so that they can bypass this exorbitant extortion that's taking place by the state of Mississippi. Now, here in our state, we have intrastate calls. Our Public Regulation Commission has limited the cost of those, so they're relatively cheap. They're only a couple of dollars each, which adds up over a period of a month. But our commission regulators have been tough on that, but you can't regulate the cost of out-of-state calls because those are federal. And those were some controls put in by the FCC under previous President Obama, which have been challenged in the court, and the Trump administration has scrapped those limits. So now if it's an interstate call, it's whatever the market will bear. But I wanted to read the names of the dead.
Michael Briones, 22. Lawrence C. Cardone, 24. Nick Coca, 30. Richard J. Fierro, 26. James C. Foley, 19. Donald J. Gossens, 23. Philip C. Hernandez, 30. Valentino E. Aramillo, 35. Kelly E. Johnson, 26. Stephen Lucero, 25. Joe Madrid, 38. Ramon Madrid, 40. Archie M. Martinez, 25. Joseph A. Mirabal, 24. Ben G. Moreno, 20. Gilbert O. Moreno, 25. Thomas O'Meara, 25. Filiberto M. Ortega, 25. Frank J. Ortega, 20. Paulina Paul, 36. James Perrin, 34. Robert F. Quintanilla, 29. Robert L. Rivera, 28. Vincent E. Romero, 34. Herman D. Russell, 26. Juan M. Sanchez, 22. Frankie J. Cedillo, 31. Larry W. Smith, 31. Leo J. Tenorio, 25. Thomas C. Tenorio, 28. Mario Uraste, 28, Danny D. Waller, 26, and Russell M. Werner, 22.
You look at Danny's offense, serving 1 to 5 years for credit card fraud.
And he was at a penitentiary for that?
Well, there was a number of them that were in for relatively minor offenses. Now, New Mexico's come a long way since then, but the gruesome way these people were killed.
Yes, I watched a little bit of a video clip. There's like almost like a chalk outline. Almost, there's a outline of where a body laid, and they said they tried all kinds of different ways to get the stuff off, but they couldn't get it off. Someone got decapitated. That's unbelievably horrific.
Polino, that the one had a iron bar driven through his from ear to ear, and that was for a sexual offense. He was in serving time for a sexual offense. These were people who had been targeted as snitches or who had sexual offenses or for just whatever savage reason they could come up with. But this is what happens can be a result of running a snitch system. They were going straight to the PC unit to get these people. And some of them managed to barricade themselves and not be apprehended by the mob. But these people were savage, and they administered such horrible, unthinkable, it's just hard to even talk about it. But these people some of them were serving just such minor, short sentences. And when their families saw them off to prison, they never expected anything like this to happen. And we let them down.
We're making a comparison of harsh treatment back then to what has happened at Parchment in Mississippi in the last, I don't remember the date, but it was three weeks ago. And you had 13 people go down, and somebody just died in the last couple of days too.
Yeah, the lessons are there for Mississippi and Alabama and for any state to learn. We already know what we did wrong. We know categorically where we failed and what was the. I mean, did the inmates have a right to do this? No, they didn't. And so I'm not justifying the savagery. But they had tried for years to get attention to what had been going on in the penitentiary of New Mexico. And it was not a high priority because I've said on the podcast before, the governor of Mississippi, Alabama, they're not going to stand up and say, I'll tell you what I want to do. I want to funnel more money into our prisons. I tell you what, because that's what we need to do. It's the moral thing to do. That's just not a vote getter. So prisons stay on the back burner by and large until there's an incident. And then the governor has a beautiful opportunity to say, well, folks, we've neglected our prisons for a while, and we're going to have to make some investments in prisons if we're going to keep locking up this many people. But instead, the governor says it's because of cell phones. It's rather pathetic, governor, rather pathetic.
Let me play the clip, Larry.
We're cracking down on criminal coordination by using the managed access system to prevent contraband cell phones from being used in all of Parchment's housing units. These phones have been illegal for years, but they've been snuck in. And they're being used to coordinate gang activity throughout the Mississippi system and even throughout the country. That was a large part of what caused the recent series of killings to escalate as much as it did. It's a real problem, and it's got to be taken seriously to save lives.
So, the way that I'm looking at this, there were pictures sent to news outlets of the completely horrible conditions that these men and I guess just these men were living in. And because of that, it brought light to the problem, which is what really caused the riot. But the governor's blaming it on the cell phones as that's what caused the riot. But really, I'm sure the people were writing home to mom and dad and to different organizations saying, the conditions here are atrocious. And then maybe investigators come out and they can't even make it through the door, or the administration only takes them to the best unit so that they don't see all these terrible conditions. So they just were sweeping it under the rug, and they just had a powder keg, and then eventually it exploded.
That is exactly what happened. I'm certain that that's what happened here. And like I say, it was a combination of all those things coming together of no programming, inadequate level of staffing, and adequate training of staff. It was the perfect storm And that's what's going to happen in Alabama and Mississippi in any prison system. If you're going to lock people up, you have a responsibility to keep them safe. Their sentence is a loss of their freedom, not of their life, unless they're sentenced in the states where they have a death penalty. But they're sentenced to a loss of their freedom. We have a duty to keep them safe while they're losing their freedom. I'm sorry, that may cost money, but that's our job to do that as a society.
Another piece of this is Jen in chat asks, why do they think, or excuse me, who do they think is sneaking in the phones? I'm sure that inmates have their ways of doing them, but it seems that it would be significantly easier for an officer to bring one in and then do a wink, wink, nod, nod, quid pro quo with a guard that's doing the check-in and the shift change stuff. And then the phone makes it in and they drop it off. They make $200-$400, whatever that number is. And now there's a phone on the inside. I'm pretty sure that's the more likely avenue than someone putting a phone somewhere for them to bring it in.
Well, of course, most of the contraband is introduced into prison by staff. There's no disputing that. And you would never eliminate all contraband from coming to prisons. The only way you'd eliminate all contraband would be to not have humans coming in and out of prisons, and that's not possible. So you're going to have contraband entered into prisons. But it is enhanced in terms of when you take the salary structure of the they're paying these people $12, $13 an hour to be responsible. It's when you write home to mom when you're in college, very few people that I've met in my life, and I've got a few decades behind me, have said, well, I can tell you what, mom, when I get my degree, I can't wait to go work in a jailhouse.
Yeah, I've never heard of anybody that tries to come up and that's what they aspire to. I want to go to the moon, but my second choice is to be a prison guard. Ashley, do you have anything to add?
First of all, I'm going to be a little less diplomatic than what Larry is being. The whole thing about somebody hiding the cell phones in there is a bunch of BS. Cases across the U.S., and you can open any news page, and on any given month, there is a guard somewhere that is bringing in contraband, drugs, and cell phones, because they make more money off the cell phones than they do even off the drugs. The thing is that the whole thing about, oh, it's being used to coordinate gang activity, BS. I'm waving the BS flag. Most of the reason, and Larry has already pointed this out, that people have cell phones in prisons and what they're using them for is to talk to their families, because their families don't have money to put on the books so that they can afford phone calls and commissary and everything else, because it's become such a racket and a money-making activity. And so you're cutting off people that are stuck in a hotbed of activity from any outside family support system, anything like that. And then you add to that the guards coming in, and if they're being abusive or being bullies or anything else, you're just pouring gasoline on a raging fire. So it's a whole bunch of stuff. And I get it. That's a hard job. And I think we've established that none of us woke up in the morning and went, you know what? That is my first career choice, and I'm going to spend the rest of my life going to college and everything else to be there. And I tell the guards when I go visit my clients at jail, I couldn't do that job. I don't have the patience for somebody screaming obscenities at me and banging on the wall because they're really upset. But it is a two-way street, and there needs to be more training. There needs to be more resources. And Larry's absolutely right. Nobody ever wants to put money into a prison system or into anything else to make these conditions better. And then we see this stuff happen and we pay the price. So it isn't because there's cell phones coming in. There's been a cell phone problem in prisons for years and years and years. Georgia has had a no cell phone policy for ever and ever. So no, they can't blame it on that. They need to be looking internally and solve the issue.
And that's going to cost some money, Ashley.
Yeah, Larry, let me throw this back at you from the policy side. I understand that we aren't willing to throw in the money to do it, but that comes from the voters voting for who would be the executive who then appoints the Department of Corrections head. And I mean that, and then the legislator not putting forth the money. I mean, this falls, what I'm getting at is that this falls on us, that we the people.
Yes. I have no problem saying that, but we the people do not like taxes. we have so vilified taxes since the 70s with Proposition 13 was the beginning of the heyday of anti-taxation in this country. And we've convinced ourselves that our taxes are so high in the United States, which they're really not compared to the countries that we like to compare, as we like to pretend we're more similar to. But taxing Americans at any level, when you start talking about, give you an example, we just raised the vehicle excise tax here from 3 to 4%, where it's been, had been stuck for decades and decades. So when you buy a vehicle, we don't charge the sales tax. I think Georgia just levies the regular state sales tax on a vehicle, but we don't do that. They're exempt from sales tax. We raised it from 3% of the sales price to 4% after it having been there for decades. And they complained about that. And then they raised the gasoline tax for a few pennies that had been stuck at the same level since 1993. And the last time the gasoline tax had been adjusted was in 1993. So what we're approaching right at 30 years of inflation and the per gallon assessment being eroded by inflation and plus the declining consumption had rendered the revenue coming into the road fund. You have declining consumption because of increased fuel efficiency, and you have 30 years almost of inflation, and the people just pitched a fit. You know, there they go again, those liberal tax and spend. Point is, Alabama needs to spend money. Mississippi needs to spend money, but nobody wants to pay that money. And when you go out and say, look, our corrections department, this article says needs about $900 billion in Alabama. They've got almost double, 170%, which is not quite double, of what the capacity of the system was designed for, it being held in custody. And nobody wants to pay that tax. So it's like we can wring our hands. And if we don't want to spend any money, we need to cut some people loose. A lot of people, not just some people, but an awful lot of people need to be cut loose. And that's where it is.
We have an opinion article that is talking about granting clemency is one possible solution. Put together some sort of panel, figure out who may or may not deserve clemency, and then let the gubna say you get to go home early.
Well, that's turning loose a tidal wave of crime on us, Andy. We can't have that.
Is a fair alternative to have 13 people, and 40 years ago 33 people. Like, I mean, you know, this is like a road warrior with Mad Max, whatever. I mean, this is about as raw, brutal humanity that you could come up with.
It is the story about the Alabama moving 600 inmates from Holman. I think that's why they pronounce it.
Yes, I believe so.
You remember last week we talked about decades old prison. That one's a 51 year old facility. And what I was trying to make a point of last week, I don't know how eloquently I succeeded, but society has changed. The people that designed an institution 50 years ago, they weren't dealing with the issues we're dealing with today. 50 years ago, the profile of an inmate was completely different because who we incarcerated was different. The prisons had not become the de facto mental health facilities that they are today. We didn't have the opioid crisis today. Managing a prison 50 years ago is different than managing a prison today. But since the facility, there's only so much adaptation you can do to an old facility. Yes, you can put in some high tech. You can go and you can string wires and put cameras in. But in terms of if you've got a linear supervision system versus a direct supervision, in the old days, they didn't build for direct. Nowadays, most modern facilities that have been built in the last 25, 30 years. There is a person inside the housing unit, or if they're not inside the housing unit, they're overlooking the housing units from a control panel where they have direct line of sight. We didn't have direct line of sight prisons 50 years ago. If you go into Holman, you'd probably find very little of that because that's not the way they were designed that long ago. So prisons have not changed as the population has changed and the needs of the prisons have changed. You've got these decades old institutions that just are not designed for what they're trying to do with them today. And it makes it very difficult to keep people safe.
Yeah, I'm thinking of Jackson State Prison in Georgia, and it's I'm picturing even like if you've seen the movie The Green Mile, where it's just a long hallway with cells in stacked next to in a parallel, I guess that would be series, in a series fashion versus what you were just describing, where more like an open dorm, and from one central place they have line of sight. The walls are low, there are no high walls in the shower. Like it would be incredibly difficult for you to hide anywhere in there, and they have pretty much full line of sight from all of the units from a central place where somebody can watch them.
And Jackson, I think, was built in the 1960s. So it's a very old institution. I don't know how much they've added to it and renovated it. But the prisons that they built that many decades are just not suitable for today. But again, these are hundreds of millions of dollars worth of infrastructure. And if you look around what state legislators are grappling with, they're grappling with no taxes, because that's horrible to think about raising taxes. And they're grappling with schools that need new infrastructure, colleges and universities that need infrastructure, transportation facilities, bridges and roads that need infrastructure, senior citizen centers that are needing infrastructure. All these things that are needing capital outlay. And when you look at how many votes you get out of prison, having a good corrections policy, everything I just mentioned above the prison list turns out more votes for you than prisons.
Let me throw this at you, Ashley, and I'd like to get yours in a second also. While I was gone, as I recall, in a county nearby where I am, they went to a 4-day school week to save money. So they chose to not spend, how do I want to word this? They chose to reduce the school days to save money versus putting any more money into the prison system. And I was like, that doesn't even make any sense to me, because probably more education would keep people out of prison. Obviously, that's a generation from now, most likely. But I just couldn't really. Anyway, they decided it didn't work, so they went back to the normal school week. But anyway,
well, it's tough. It's tough on the elected officials, and I'll let Ashley jump in here. But yes, it's very tough because you're competing against an anti-tax mentality of the voter, and you're needing capital, and prisons are just not a high priority. Sorry.
And the funny part of that being, because Larry's an expert and an old hand at being up at the legislature. So he sees this like every single session. I got to view it firsthand, even though I was peripherally aware of it, where everybody's coming in trying to do these, let's get tough on crime bills, let's add this crime, let's do this and everything. And then it comes down to, how are we going to fund the additional lawyers, the additional judges, if we're going to increase and make mandatory times on stuff, how are we going to fund the prisons? And nobody says a word about it. They ask about it. And they claim, oh, well, this could be bad. And then it's so sexy to pass these new crimes and these new bills that make it look like they're being tough on crime, but they don't think it through, where we're just going to keep throwing people into prisons like Jackson. Jackson is a really good example in Georgia, where you keep funneling people in. And then every time somebody violates probation or parole for testing positive and you send them off to prison, you're just increasing the amount of people in there and not increasing any of the resources or capacity. So no, it's not good for legislators to come back and say, hey, we need more money for the prisons too, because everybody goes, oh no, you don't. What do they need? They don't need anything else. And that's just not true. They don't see it as an entire system, an ecosphere that they're messing with.
And one other point to make is, if you couldn't do the time, then you shouldn't have done the crime.
How about we start right back to what you were talking about, decreasing the school days so that we don't have to put any more money into prisons? How about we find other things, more resources to help people initially, maybe drug treatment services, mental health services, economic stuff, a whole bunch of other stuff. Why don't we start at the root of the problem? And giving kids less time to get in trouble might be one of them as well. So I'm a little bit baffled as you are, but I used to feel that way. I don't feel that way about if you can't do the crime or you can't do the time, don't do the crime, because I think that there's so many other factors at play. It's just not a simple explanation like that.
So I just did Wikipedia on Georgia Diagnostic Classification System. It was opened in 1968, which was consistent with my memory. And renovated last in 1998, which is quite some time back. And 1998, I don't know to what extent the renovation is, but Andy, if you've been there, you've described it as I thought it existed. It's not a direct supervision facility. You know, it's
And in 2008, it was not a club paradise either. That I promise.
And also it
had very poor climate control.
Well, first of all, when they were building that in 1968, they wouldn't have been trying to maximize comfort And then those HVAC systems and all those systems would be very, very old in terms of
how about non-existent
compared to how they would, how if you were trying to design one today in terms of energy management and how you would be able to I mean, a prison built today, unless they have the Texas and Florida model where you try to roast them out and kill them from health.
Or the Arpaio model where you roast them out, right.
But if you build a prison today, theoretically the climate control is far better. And that's not a complaint we get a lot in about our prisons, although it's pretty hot here in parts of the state, but we don't get a lot of complaining about the climate, we don't try to roast the prisoners. That's not one of the things that we fail at here, but there are plenty of other failures we have. That's not one of them.
No, we freeze them out here.
I've experienced that too. I don't want to diminish the impact of this event. Is there anything else before we continue on?
Well, I hope that if there's any chance of a family member out there that might have listened to this or find out about this, that at least we haven't forgotten.
Very well.
And that we care that this happened.
And we will never know what some of these young men could have grown up to be. When I say young men, they're in their 20s, which means that they had 40, 50 years of life ahead of them. And those that were serving small, relatively minor crimes, we don't know if they would have turned their life around. We don't know because they never got the chance.
Exactly.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible.
I'm for reforming our criminal justice system. Too many people are locked up in America.
The next two articles are related to an individual named Rafael Ruiz, who served 35 years. And then was exonerated because of DNA evidence that was finally tested. And so I think, Larry, that this goes near and dear to your heart about the whole due process process. And I, in reading the information, the DNA testing that we are able to do now, like on a whim that you see all glitzy on TV shows these days, was just coming into being used. But the way that they describe that the police sort of pressured the victim to like point at a door, like that's where the guy lived, and they got a guy who looked vaguely similar, and they almost like coerced her into accusing this guy of doing it, and he's denying it, obviously, and then denies it, gets out of prison, and then in the end, they exonerate him for the DNA evidence.
I think that's more of an ashy one, but I know that as a general rule that once a conviction has been had, the burden shifts in terms of who has to prove what, and undoing convictions is it's extremely difficult. Only those who have gone to trial actually really have a prayer of a chance. Those who have done pleas have virtually no chance. And I said virtually, not absolutely, but convictions are defended by every state, whether it be Arkansas, whether it be Florida, whether it be New Mexico. And oftentimes they will do everything they can to thwart the entry of evidence that would exonerate them. And since I've never been a prosecutor, I can't speak to why they do that. I'm guessing that it's because of finality. They don't want to constantly be spending their time on old cases, but we've got a veteran prosecutor, former prosecutor here, so we can hear their perspective on why they strive so hard and burn the midnight oil to keep a conviction. And whether or not it was a the right conviction of the right person, because again, I make the same analogy I make to the police about the police wanting the bad one. If we've got a conviction that's doubtful that person did it, if the prosecutor has the remotest amount of ethics, it seems like to me you would want the guilty person to come in and you'd want the innocent person to go out, because as the guilty person is still out there roaming the streets, you haven't given that victim justice, because that perpetrator is potentially going to repeat or has been repeating. So I don't understand it at all. Anyway, let's hear the prosecutor's explanation.
So I think it actually goes more along the lines of, I don't want to simplify it and say ego, but let's start with that. So you have prosecutors who, when they take on a case, in theory, are not supposed to try it or do anything else unless they believe that justice is being done. Now, let's break that down, because what it really means in your average prosecutors, not all prosecutors, just like law enforcement and everything else, there's good ones, there's bad ones. But in your average prosecutor, when they go to try a case, the only way that they're viewing the evidence is as if the person is guilty. So everything that they're looking at, they see it as supporting the guilt. So trying to go back and appeal something and point out how it didn't support the guilt is counterintuitive to most prosecutors. They look at it and go, no, that shows they were guilty. And they don't look at it from any other direction. The other thing is that once they actually convict someone, instead of wanting to get the person off on an appeal or cooperate with it, a lot of them take it personally that they did something possibly unethical by convicting somebody, if in fact the appeal is overturned on various grounds. And they take it very, very personally. Judges take it personally when they're overturned on appeals, instead of going, okay, this is an opportunity for me to learn, an opportunity for me to look at this from a different light. They go all the way down in flames if they have to, maintaining the person was guilty and the courts got it wrong. And I have viewed that firsthand from both sides of the law.
It seems that they should lose sleep over putting an innocent person behind bars, more so than lose sleep over, oh crap, I got it wrong, they're going to overturn me and make me look foolish.
See, most of the prosecutors that I know, and not all of them again, and me in particular, believe that as you're going through the evidence before you ever get to trial, you're not going to hit a stage where you're going to put somebody on trial for something they didn't do, unless you believe it strongly and there's evidence to support it. So once you get to that trial stage, everything in your brain is going towards they're guilty. And there's no more, I believe they're innocent at all, because that should have gone off the table by the time you charge the case. And I think that's the way most of them view it. What they're not taking into consideration, and you see this time in and time again, where there's political pressure to prosecute somebody that maybe didn't do it, or like you see in Mr. Ruiz's case, where they're like, oh, we got to get a conviction at any cost. That is just bad prosecution. It is not upholding justice. It is not upholding the Constitution. And prosecutors have a duty, as I've said before, to do justice, not get convictions. They represent the community. They also represent the rights of the accused. And that is what the prosecutor is supposed to do if they're doing their job ethically.
Let me play a clip real quick that I pulled from something.
I saw a quote that I loved. A Judge Blackstone from way back said, I would rather 10 guilty people escape than one innocent person suffer.
Yeah. Yeah.
That seems to fly in the face of that.
Right. I mean, there's the entire system of due process and the Constitution surrounding trial provisions and the rights of the accused are all centered around that belief. Better that many go free than one single innocent person get locked up for something they didn't do. So is
Mr. Ruiz the just the outlier out of all this? I think we have fairly decent stats that maybe 10% of the people are actually, I don't want to say necessarily fully innocent, but we can go and say fully innocent, but they're at least not as guilty as they were charged.
Of the crime that they were charged with.
Right. And So is this just the complete outlier, that this is the one that slipped through? Meanwhile, the other 2 million people that are locked up, they actually did it, but this is the guy that slipped through the cracks somehow?
I'm not sure what the percentage is. I'm trying to think if 10% is around the range, but that the Innocence Project has uncovered a pretty decent amount through that DNA project. So we know that it's not an outlier. We know this happens. And what I would hope is that the jurisdictions that this is happening in take a look at how they prosecute and their training. And I don't know that that's what's going to happen given politics and human egos, but I would hope that they go, you know what? before we put somebody on trial for something, we better make sure we have DNA. We better make sure we have this. We better make sure that there's no question in the witness statements or anything else. And maybe we wouldn't arrive at a situation like Mr. Ruiz's.
Well, I don't know that I can add much to it. I feel like that everything Ashley says is correct, but there's no mechanism to enforce that. It would be ideal if everybody operated the office the way that my admired DAs in Boulder did, but they don't. And the reason why they don't is because that's not popular with the people. Poor Alex got hounded from office because he wouldn't indict the Ramseys for the death of John Podesta. He said, we just don't have the evidence. We just don't have the evidence for it. You know, that so-called ransom note asking for $111,000 or whatever his bonus was that year was not sufficient. And there are prosecutors who will indict and hope that the evidence materializes later, because it satisfies the thirst we have sensational reporting, and the mob mentality sits in. Someone's got to be held accountable, and the DAs are under enormous pressure. And I'm not being dismissive of that pressure. I mean, you look at the Atlanta child murders back in the 1980 and 81 when Wayne Williams got prosecuted. What was it? 29, 30, 31 boys, young men who had shown turned up dead, and mostly in the Chattahoochee River and surrounding areas. That was Lewis Slate was under. That's the DA in Atlanta. He was under enormous pressure to do something about that. But it takes a really principled person to say, "No, sir, I am not going to charge this person until I have evidence sufficient to convince a jury beyond a reasonable doubt." And I'm the first person who has to be convinced. I have to be convinced that this is beyond a reasonable doubt. How do we instill that value? Because it's obviously not happening across the land.
Let me throw this at you from a different tack, Larry. I believe there was a component of Obamacare that was not about physicians scheduling tests and just prescribing stuff. There was something to be said for like a performance-based outcome, and that would be the reward for the doctors to like, hey, we've identified this most accurately and we've identified the most efficient form of treatment. That was a component of there, if I recall correctly. Couldn't we try to figure out a framework to put this on the prosecutors? Like, it is not about, I had a 50% increase in prosecutions from last term from that other guy on the other side of the aisle, so you should vote for me again. Could we figure out a way to actually, I don't know, maybe we could have a prosecutor oversight committee that could evaluate the effectiveness of a prosecutor?
Well, how would you determine effectiveness? One way of measuring
effectiveness? I don't know. I totally don't know. If we had an independent counsel that could like go back through and evaluate whether they did their job effectively, then you would have a scorecard.
Well, but what determines what's effective?
I don't know. It's just a hypothetical.
Yeah. Well, if we could figure out what constitutes an effective prosecutor, I think securing convictions is what we will largely consider effective today. A prosecutor goes out and tells you that they like to throw around their statistics. When I took the job, there was a backlog of 472 unindicted felony cases, and I've whittled it down, and we've taken care of this backlog, and blah, blah, blah. That's what they run on. So would you also separate the people from the decision making? Would we conclude that the people that vote for DAs are not sophisticated enough to understand the nuances of a DA's job, a prosecutor's job, is to seek justice and protect the rights of the accused? The average person doesn't understand that. They don't understand that special rule of professional conduct that a prosecutor has. It's above and beyond a normal attorney. So how would we deal with the people component?
I don't know. And I was, and as you were saying all of that, I'm thinking over to the progressive prosecutors that we have now, like the Larry Krasners, and they are getting tomatoes thrown at them left and right for going back and finding people that were wrongly convicted and letting them go. I mean, they're getting beat down for doing what we are describing here now.
They are. And let's add another nuance to that too, because as Larry can tell you, I'm living this firsthand too, where the elected DAs and the elected attorney generals, when a case gets a lot of media attention and it's sensationalized, they're under tremendous pressure to show that they're being tough on crime and everything else. And they will indict things or press things forward, knowing that they're going to lose it at some point. But then they can point the finger at the judges and say, well, we did what we were supposed to do, but the judges failed you. And the judges who are elected officials are like, well, the prosecutor didn't bring the charges right, or there's this, this, and this. And there's all this finger pointing when, at the end of the day, if everybody would just take a look in the mirror and do what's right without any type of oversight, maybe we could combat the problem. But that's just a ideal utopic vision.
And I don't have the answers either. I brought up Wayne Williams, and some of our listeners will have no idea. That was a series of murders in Atlanta in the early 1980s. And the national attention and even the federal government was breathing down Lewis Slayton's neck. And to Slayton's credit, he withstood that pressure and did not charge just for the sake of charging. When they finally did charge Wayne Williams, who was ultimately convicted, and he sits in the state prison in Jackson to this very day, proclaiming his innocence. But when they charged Slayton, when Slayton did charge Williams, he was reluctant about doing it because they were relying on what they call fiber evidence in those days. We didn't have DNA. We had some carpet fiber, and the fiber from that carpet had been analyzed. And of course, it's no telling how many thousands of homes that same fiber was in. But the fiber that was one of the kids had been wrapped up in that carpet fiber matched what had been taken out of Williams's home in a search warrant. So they had that as one link in the puzzle he maintained his innocence and was convicted. He still maintains his innocence, and he will die in Jackson maintaining his innocence because his appeals are exhausted. And barring some miracle, I mean, whether he's guilty or not, he'll die in prison.
Tragic. I don't like it. The only other one thing that I wanted to bring up. So this guy was exonerated from finally getting some DNA evidence tested. I hear programs all the time about the bajillions, pick whatever number that is very large, of all the rape kits that continue to go untested, that everyone is all like, man, we need to get these things tested so we can find the guy that did it. But it could also potentially exonerate people at the same time. I hadn't thought about that until this particular article came up.
I didn't actually think about it that way either, because everybody is pressing, and there's a lot of fuss being made here in New Mexico as well about the backlog of rape kits that go years and years and years. And I didn't think about the exoneration factor. I thought about it from the other perspective, because that's the way that the public is doing it too. So that's actually interesting that it could be exonerating people. However, the only thing I would say in terms of that is the more recent cases probably didn't press forward without the DNA. Back in the Wayne Gilbert days and the days of Mr. Ruiz and everything, they didn't have the DNA testing that we do now. Now it's kind of the norm not to proceed unless you have DNA.
I thought that they're like in Chicago, there's some like 20,000 rape kits that just sit in a vault. Are you saying that you believe that those are from decades old, that they're not current-ish?
Oh, yes. The ones here, they're, some of the rape backlog is, I think, they're also like 20 or 40,000, and Larry may have the number off the top of his head because it's come up at the legislature, but those are 10 to 20 years old as well.
So they're not more recent-ish?
Not all of them.
Yeah, there can be recent in the batch, but what happened was that the science developed faster than the funding developed to carry it out. When you're building budgets, this is a complicated thing that people don't understand. So when you're building budgets for law enforcement, when something new comes along, that's not in your existing budget, which is the blueprint that you start from. You have X number of personnel, you have X amount for offices, X amount for blah, blah, blah. But these rape kits, this was relatively new in terms of what all they can do with the testing. And the forensics are not cheap. So a police agency of a small police agency may not even have any option other than turning it over to the state. Well, the state hasn't funded, because again, we hate taxes so much. So the state,
that was where that was going to go.
the state had not built in the funding for the testing for these kits. So you send them up to the state lab. Say you're the Clovis PD, and you don't have a lab. You can't do all that. So you send your stuff up to the Department of Public Safety in Santa Fe, and all the other agencies are sending in all these gobs of forensic evidence, and you have two forensic technicians because that's all you had funded in your budget, and you've got more than what two can do over the next 20 years. And that's how the backlog builds up. And it's one of those things that's not glitzy to talk about it until, because you have to say again, where do we find these funds? We've got to find funding, and everybody's got their paw out. I wish people would understand in the budgetary cycle in a state legislature, just like in the National Congress, there's all these paws out saying, I need. And you've got these people that are having to make these priority choices to give funding, and funding just didn't keep up. And that's how we ended up having this backlog. And there'll be the cynics out there that'll say, yeah, because they were taking too many trips to Hawaii and on these political junkets, and they should have spent the money on that. And that's fine. You're entitled to that opinion. But the reality is that the funding just didn't keep pace. So now we're going back and having to backfill. And particularly the last 10 years after we went into the recession of 08-09, New Mexico's funding stayed relatively flat for about almost 10 years until we've had the resurgence in oil and gas production. Then we've gotten some revenue now the last couple of years, so we can actually go back and fill in some of these holes. But funding has been a problem.
Gotcha. Well, let's circle back, because I accidentally skipped something. What is HB 43 and HB 237? What kind of crazy hieroglyphics code are you sending me?
Well, House Bill 43, that was a piece of legislation that was introduced into the session, pre-filed in our state legislature here, to close the out-of-state loophole for those who, we don't have a catch-all provision in New Mexico law. So everybody who wants to pack up, come to New Mexico, come while you can, because in order to be required to register, you have to have an equivalent offense to one of those offenses on our list. And our list is not as long as some states' lists. We have a longer list than I'd like to have, but it's not nearly as long as a lot of other states. Our list of offenses has 12 enumerated offenses or their attempts to commit those offenses. You can look at other states where they have 20, 30, you know, sometimes more offenses. But in order to be required to register, you have to have an offense that's equivalent. Well, how would you figure out if it's equivalent? Well, there has to be some sort of determination made. And that's an expensive process. And the state just hasn't bothered to make those determinations. So we finally filed a lawsuit. That was our first Liberty and Justice state lawsuit against registration, was to challenge that we've got hundreds of people here who've not undergone any type of process to determine if they're equivalent. And probably most of them are equivalent, but they haven't received any due process. So we're trying to establish due process. Well, this was the answer. House Bill 43 was the answer. We'll just gut that and just say that they have to register in New Mexico if they have to register in any other state. Well, that is an option that we had considered that they would do when we filed the lawsuit. I mean, we were smart enough to figure that out, that that would be an answer. We were confident enough that we thought we could work the legislature process and keep that from becoming law, because that's a misguided policy. So that was what House Bill 43 was. And it was in its first committee Tuesday. And Ashley and I went up and we both testified and spoke. And Ashley will tell you it's her first experience in the Capitol and how thrilled she was to be there and how enlightening it was. But at the end of the debate about House Bill 43, unlike most of the states that go into the deep bowels somewhere and hold a hearing and cloaked in secrecy in the middle of the night, we actually have a vote after they've taken public comment and after they've actually, the lawmakers have debated amongst themselves. And after all the debate was had on House Bill 43, which was designed to moot our lawsuit, and they used the Jeffrey Epstein hoopla that Jeffrey owned a ranch here in New Mexico, and he was told he didn't have to register because his prostitution offense in Florida is not equivalent to anything in New Mexico. So they tried to sensationalize that. We kept their bill from moving forward. We kept their bill from getting a due pass recommendation. And I'm mighty proud of that. And even though I'm proud of it, and we patted ourselves on the back and we sent out an email blast to our supporters, we received a critical email back saying, oh, really? Did you people do that? Why don't you be more transparent? Why don't you tell us how you did it? Let's see exactly what you did. I found that email very troubling because we can't even tell everybody everything we did, because we wouldn't be able to do what we do if everybody knew how we do what we do. So that's kind of like Rumsfeld said, that there's the, what was it, the known unknowns, and that there's things we don't know.
Yeah, there's four of them.
Yeah. Some of the things we do, we cannot publicly tell people what we do, because if we did, we would not be able to do them. So, but the proof of the pudding should be in the tasting. Tell me how many states. I've responded back in an email. I told the guy, I said, well, let me just tell you this. We had a sensational bill promoted by the boogeyman of Jeffrey Epstein, and pretty high profile. There's very few people who haven't heard of Jeffrey Epstein. And we stopped their Epstein boogeyman from carrying the day. And you name another state. I said, tell me about Pennsylvania with Sandusky. Did you stop anything in Pennsylvania? And I went through a litany of states. I said, tell me, did you stop Dennis Hastert from eradicating the statute of limitations after all the sensationalism? Did you stop the changes that happened in Michigan after Dr. Larry Nassar? No, you didn't. So rather than being so critical and wanting to know how did we do it and prove that you did it, why wouldn't you just say thank you? Congratulations. That's enough ranting. Go ahead, Ashley.
No, that was pretty close to my ranting. So we went up there. It was super, super exciting for me. Larry, like I said, is an old hand at that, but I had never actually been up to the Capitol in that capacity. And we did. And we watched them table it. We watched the debate, despite the fact that there was some disingenuous behavior, to quote a Larryism, from one of the members of the committee minimizing the equivalency portion of that bill. And it was really good. It did not make it out of committee. However, dun, dun, dun. What they did was now Bill 237, which Larry and I are actively working on, and which we've spent the better part of the weekend working on. Right, Larry?
That's correct. And we got more to go. We're analyzing it and putting in analysis for the committee upon request of the committee analyst, by the way. And I won't say which committee, but we were requested to provide an analysis. They're very impressed with the work that we've done.
Correct.
Riddle me this, sir, if you would. I'm trying to think, it was three-ish episodes where you said if you are going to support bills, you are in the train boosting business, but if you're going there to stop something, you're in the train wrecking business. Which side of the equation were you on here?
We're in the wrecking business.
We're in the wrecking business.
Right. And again, I know that you're not going to divulge a bunch of details, but you gave me some details. Can you, like, how many votes and how did you get, like, how did you wreck the train?
Well,
Larry,
is that getting too specific? It's getting very, very specific.
But the bottom line was they needed three votes and they could not get to the magic number they needed to pass the bill.
That's what I wanted you to say. I didn't want more than that.
So
I didn't want to get too specific.
It's a numbers game, and like I say, being that we actually, unlike all the other states I've traveled to, we actually vote at the end of the bill. And I emphasize this because none of the rest of them do that. They actually have a hearing. Sometimes they're open, but they're 2 weeks later and you've already forgotten about it. And the emotions are not there and they're not facing the people that just spoke to them. And they do it. As far as I'm concerned, it's a cowardly way to do it. But we actually have the debate after the public has spoken. The lawmakers debate amongst themselves. And then there's a motion made. And they could not get the three votes to out of a 5-member committee. They could not round up three votes, and they would have had three votes except one of the Republicans who normally would have been in favor of it. She ducked out because she had a disagreement in terms of how they were conducting the process. And I actually agree with her about her disagreement. She was right that they should not have heard that bill because it had not been on the calendar for a full 24 hours in its amended fashion. Because they had substituted from what had been introduced to a committee substitute, and that did not give us time. We were not able in the public to actually see what they were voting on because that wasn't the bill that we had analyzed. there had been changes of a significant nature. And this Republican was irritated because they weren't following the rules, and she was correct about that. So she ducked out, and that kept them from getting. She normally would have been a do pass, but she ducked out. They couldn't get to their five, to their three of five.
Someone in chat who shall remain nameless has said you called her state cowardly.
I did do that. Yes, that's the way they do it. That's the way they do it in Nebraska. That's the way they do it in Maryland. They do it that way all over the country. I have not met a state where they actually have the courage to vote while the people are there.
And is that written into your constitution, or is that
No, it's just the way
house
they do
rules
it
or whatever.
It's just the way they do it. They move a bill. It seems like a no-brainer. You schedule a bill to be heard, and you hear the bill, and the people have traveled great distances. Now, Maryland, it's not quite as great a distance, but here it's a great distance. I mean, Maryland's a much smaller geographic state, but you travel a great distance and you take time off work and you put your energy and your soul into it, and you want to know what they're going to do, but they don't do anything.
Right.
They say, thank you for coming, folks. Stay tuned. We'll decide something at some point and we'll put it on the website.
Interesting. And New Mexico is the only one that you know of that does it that way?
So far, now,
the other way you're describing?
All the listeners we've got, someone who's been in the Capitol, if they vote on a piece of legislation in committee after the committee has debated it, please let me know so I can add you to the states that are not cowards.
Interesting.
but I don't know of any state. We could ask Georgia, just had a hearing on the GPS bill last week. As far as I know, they didn't vote on it during the committee with the people watching them.
And at next session, could they just vote to change the rules and then they would do it at a later date to do the vote? Or is it enshrined somewhere more permanent?
I think ours is mostly just tradition. The committee's just, it's a part of how they've always done it. You hear a bill and you make a decision.
And I'm not trying to bring up the impeachment stuff, but all through this, they were like, okay, so they're going to have a hearing about whether they're going to have witnesses. And that was them establishing the rules for how the whole process was going to go through there on the spot. They could have had different rules. So it's not a constitutional thing at the state level that they've made these things in place. These are just part of your House and Senate rules at the House or Senate leader's discretion to change the rules.
Or the members, because I'm not sure. Okay. It's always been that way since I've been here. Even the 2 years, the 2 years since I've been in the state, the Republicans controlled the House for 2 years, from 15 and 16. They didn't even attempt to change that. Now, they renamed some of the committees, and they changed having floor sessions twice a day versus once a day. They did some changes, which was their prerogative as a majority party to do that because they had the numbers. But they didn't change this longstanding tradition of making a decision after you hear a bill. I'm so spoiled. I find it totally discombobulating to go travel and sit and wait in a hot room fanning yourself and waiting for 37 people to testify, and at the end of the day not knowing a damn thing, that you're going to have to stay tuned and watch the website, and there'll be a report at some date, there'll be a committee report, and if you're lucky enough to find it, you'll get to know what they did. I find that so objectionable.
Now, is there an advantage on the other side, though, that if they decide to not vote, that they could just sort of disappear, or are they required to then vote in these other states?
No, there's some advantage. It some things disappear, and they're forgotten about. But I would rather have the vote then. There's disadvantages and advantages I can see, but I'd rather have the vote. I know what I've got to do next. If this bill's going to move, I need to know it because I've got work to do.
You sound a little bit passionate about that particular subject, by the way.
Yeah, well, I've got work to do. I need to know where this thing is going. And if it takes me 2 weeks to figure out where it's going, I don't know where to start applying pressure and where to put the resources if I don't know what's happening. So I have to watch the website to the middle of the night until they finally decide to have their meeting in their cloakroom and to vote on it. And by then, I've lost a lot of valuable time that I could have been doing work to sabotage. Because most of the time, you're going to be in the sabotage business. You're not going to be in the passing business. You're going to be in the blocking business.
Was that just the 43, or was that also 237?
For 237, we're still analyzing it, so there's really not much to report. It's scheduled for a hearing in the same committee, and our hope is that we can wreck it again. I'm not going to be overly confident. There are factors that I can't talk about that will make it more difficult to wreck, but that doesn't mean that I believe we'll be successful in keeping it from making it to the finish line, but it may not be as easy as it was on 43.
All righty, then.
I got my rights to do anything I want to do. I'm a police officer.
Well, let's move over to God, I don't even know what the mascot of this state is, to be honest with you. And that's where I'm from. Prince George County, Maryland police shooting. I love it when the police gun people down for no apparent reason, for not a justified reason. I'm being very facetious with that. A police corporal in Maryland was charged with second degree murder on Tuesday in the fatal shooting of a suspect who had been handcuffed in the front passenger seat of his patrol car the previous night. Why do we let cops kill people when they're handcuffed? I'm still baffled by this whole thing all the time.
Well, I don't think we're letting them do it. I think you read the article. He's been charged. The question is,
so that would be the sort of like the weird part of this is that somebody is actually getting charged with something.
Well, that's the point is going to make whether be convicted. Convicting a police officer is very, very difficult. Ashley can remember very well that when John Boyd was shot off the side of the mountain when he was trying to surrender a few years back, he was coming down peacefully when the officers blew him to death on camera, that our former district attorney, Carrie Brandenburg, decided that she was going to charge the cops. And you can take the story from there. How well did that work out for Ms. Brandenburg?
It was horrible for her career. And the officers stopped reporting crimes to her. It turned into utter chaos. I was still in Georgia when that actually happened. And there were people calling me from here asking me if I would come out here and run the DA. That's how bad it got.
And so, she even feared for her safety. She said that she was afraid for her safety.
Yes. They harassed her to no end because she went after law enforcement. And having been in that position before for excessive force cases or anything else like that, I completely understand. I don't think you can explain what happens when the lawmakers turn against you like that. But that goes right back. That's actually one of the turning points for law enforcement oversight committees. And that may be along the same lines as what we've been talking about.
I'm just pulling up a killings by the police by country. The second country on the list, what year is this from? I don't see what year this is from, but we have 120.5 per 100 residents. The country of Yemen has 52.8. Montenegro, Serbia. Like, there's a lot of killings in the United States by a factor of almost three before you get to the second place position.
Well, I've said that I didn't have the statistics, and I think you meant about per 100,000, not per 100. But the statistics on officer deaths have been dropping. It was far more dangerous to be a police officer in the 1970s than it is today. More police were killed on a smaller population base by triple compared to what get killed today. The opposite trend has been in place for police killings. Now, this is despite the fact that we have so many non-lethal means that we didn't have in the 1970s. When you looked at a police officer and the weaponry they were carrying in the 1970s, they had that, people called it various pejorative terms, but they had the nightstick and they had their service revolver. And that was pretty much about it. So you're either going to use your fist, you're going to use that stick, that club, or you're going to use your revolver.
Now, Barney Fife had his one little bullet in his pocket.
Nowadays, the average police officer is loaded with options, you know, from gaseous things that they can discharge that they didn't carry in those days, with a taser, to beanbag rounds, they have all these non-lethal options available to them, but yet the lethality of police conduct has gone through the roof since the 1970s. Now, explain that one to me. How is it that as we've introduced more and more non-lethal options into their arsenal, that more and more people are getting killed at the hands of the police?
I'm gonna lay out one that I think is gonna be a very radical idea, Larry. They're not using those methods.
Duh. I never considered that. And why aren't they using those methods? What are our standard operating procedures? Why are we not requiring the use of those methods? Because they seem to be quite happy. You see tasers employed all the time. You see tasers being used on people in questionable circumstances. So why are they not using the non-lethal means more often? Why did they not use, Ashley, why didn't they use the non-lethal means on John Boyd? Why did a man who was walking down to surrender, why did they need to fire at him? Tell me that. Of course, you can't tell me because it's a rhetorical question, but why?
Because they're trained to shoot to kill.
I don't even remember reading what this individual was even charged with at the time. But it doesn't seem that if he was being just detained, his hands were cuffed behind his back. Yeah, if your hands are cuffed behind your back, you really have very limited means of assaulting the officer to make him feel like his life is in danger, unless you're some sort of Superman and you can just like spread your arms apart and break the cuffs.
Well, now there you go again, Andy. You know that there are people who have very flexible joints and they can slip those cuffs under their feet and they can take them off at will. And then they can, it's your people of your mindset that causes this country to be in the peril that it's in right now, putting these officers in jeopardy. Of course, they could get out of those handcuffs. And I'm being a smart aleck here. But the average person's handcuff behind their back is very little threat. So what he did to justify that, I'd be curious to know as well, because if he was truly in handcuffs and was shot fatally, I can't imagine what you'd be doing that would justify a discharge of a fatal round.
And just to fill in the gap there, if you have anything else, Ashley, but he's the father of two. And so they just took away their dad. Gotta love it.
It's awful. Just awful.
It's called a perp walk.
It's one of the most offensive parts of the criminal justice system.
We have an article that comes from Forbes magazine talking about perp walks, that the problem, one of the initial steps that we should take in criminal justice reform needs to be fair media coverage. And you can certainly find all kinds of clips of Jeffrey Epstein, of Bill Cosby, of Harvey Weinstein, and the list just goes on and on. And it already colors the minds of the citizenry of who these people are. And obviously, if they're on TV being charged with a crime, that they are guilty.
Well, I think I would start by saying Forbes is not known to be a liberal magazine. Anybody knows the origin of Forbes? It's not one of those liberal leaning magazines. So if Forbes has recognized that there's a problem with the perp walks, that's a step in the right direction. But where this thing always breaks down is the same discussion we have about the biased media. Forbes will never connect the dots to the next part of it, is that the reason why this is done is because it's allowed. It is permitted in a free society. And the only way we could stop these perp walks would be if the big old bad government came in and said, as a matter of protection of the accused, you can't do that. And then the press would holler and howl that this is a violation of their First Amendment rights. And I would be curious if we were trying to, because obviously the press cannot suppress their urges to be the first with a story and to respond to a tipster, to a hot tip from law enforcement. So since they can't stop on their own volition, the only way we would stop them would be with some type of governmental intervention. So I wonder if Forbes would be willing to say that as a member of the press, and although we do believe in the press, we would encourage governmental intervention to stop us from doing what we can't stop ourselves from doing. I wonder if they would take that next step in this, because that would be the most admirable story that they could possibly run, is to say, we were wrong, we can't contain ourselves, and we need the big old bad government to stop us. I would be delighted to see Forbes move to that level of recognition that there's a problem, and I bet I'll be waiting a long time to hear them call for government intervention.
And I'm thinking to the 9/11 stuff, where just like repeatedly all day long, CNN, Fox, everybody was constantly replaying the towers falling. And eventually they said, hey, this is too traumatic. Maybe we should stop showing it. I realize that's not a terribly great comparison, but they at least decided to stop showing it. So this would be along the same lines of, if you want someone to get something of a fair trial, you don't have their picture plastered all over the newspapers and the television, showing them walking out, looking all disheveled, they got like a coat over their wrist because they don't want people to see them in handcuffs. They're trying to save face somehow. But this seems that it would go directly contrary to innocent until proven guilty.
Well, it does. But the point I'm making is the press would howl if anybody dared to propose such a prohibition. They would howl that it violates their First Amendment right to inform the public. These people have been charged, and the public has a right to know who they are and everything about them that we can dig up. And Forbes would all of a sudden, although they recognize, they in the story they said that people who have been cleared can never clear what's out there about them. They can't do that. They recognize that. But I promise you they won't. It's like the people who howl about, we've got folks who constantly say the system's not fair because people who don't have money don't get representation. And I say, okay, well, let's work through this. Let's look for a solution. Do you want to put more money into indigent defense, which may mean collection of additional assessments on someone because we need the pot of money that's available for indigent defense to grow? They say no. I said, well, do you want to limit what people who have money can spend on their own defense? Because that would be a way of equalizing. And of course, I'm not espouting either of those options. I'm just asking them because they're the ones moaning about how bad it is. And they say no. And I say, okay, well, we've just gone through a couple of options. And so since the things that come to my mind that we could do, what is your solution? Do you want to commandeer the services of private attorneys and say that we will confiscate and require you to represent them and not be well, no, we can't do that. I say, okay, well, then what can we do? And I never get an answer. I get crickets. Mr. Forbes, what can we do to cure this? Because we agree with you. What can we do?
Absolutely. Ashley, anything to add?
No, everything that Larry just said is right on point in terms of every time there's something passed or whatever, we talk about that small budget and it's like, well, are we going to put more resources into indigent defense? Some states actually require lawyers to contribute their time. It's mandatory that they do indigent defense. I don't know how they're compensated. I don't know if the state pays them per case or whatever, or if they have to do it as like pro bono time. But I think most lawyers balk at that because they have to earn a living, because they have to eat. But it does not solve the problem. I agree with Larry. There is no good answer. There needs to be a way to provide defenses for people, but I'm not sure how we do it.
At the end of the day, we're about public safety. But when it comes to kids, public safety and rehabilitation are kind of inextricably linked.
Let's move on to this article from the LA Times that California, the bastion of liberalness there, offenders under 21 would automatically be tried as juveniles under California bill. Why? I mean, if they're 18, man, I mean, even if they're 15 and they do something heinous, shouldn't we put them through the ringer and throw the entire book, the entire bookshelf at them instead of trying to hit them with kid gloves?
No, we should not. And thankfully, our state doesn't do that. We would not be able to match this if this passes in California. I don't think this will pass. But raising the age, we've all recognized that the brain development hasn't stopped at even at 21. So this is coming out of a legislator from Berkeley. I have my dubiosity it's going to pass. California has made tremendous strides already in terms of improving the juvenile justice system and cutting that down the number dramatically of people who are in custody. And I'm doubtful that this is going to pass, but at least someone had the courage to introduce it. And it's recognizing that we should look at, rather than putting more and more younger people in front of, in adult courts, which is hard to do. Ashley's a prosecutor, but Ashley, tell people how hard it is to put a juvenile in adult court in this state compared to a state like Georgia that you're somewhat familiar with. Describe what you have to do if you want to try a juvenile as an adult here.
You have to, the burden of proof for trying a juvenile as an adult here is immeasurable. It is very, very rarely done. The good reason, like I'm in total agreement that we shouldn't be putting juveniles into prison. We shouldn't be putting juveniles into even custody. We should try everything else. But to get a juvenile, even if they've committed or they're accused of murder, or even if they're convicted of murder, and doing them as a serious youthful offender here is a high burden of proof, as well as it should be. And I think it's interesting because the age that they're trying to raise it to is 21, which I believe there's a bill here, I'm not sure where it's at in the legislature, of trying to raise the age to buy cigarettes to 21, because the age to buy alcohol is also 21. And it's all based on the same premise that your brain, like Larry says, has not stopped developing. And we recognize that there isn't some magic age at 18. So why is it that we're concerned about not providing cigarettes and alcohol to somebody whose brain isn't done developing, but we have no problem throwing them in prison when they can't even formulate good concepts at that age either. So I think we should kind of line them all up. But I'm with Larry. I don't think this bill is going to pass. I think it's a great bill, but I don't think it's going to pass.
Is there something to be said, Larry, of introducing it just to sort of like, you know, blaze the trail, and then it'll maybe get tweaked, or maybe it'll just get introduced in a session or two from now, and that you're planting the seed and that will eventually grow to fruition?
Yes, there is something to be said about that. Normally, major reforms don't occur on first attempt. It takes years of work. This is going to generate some good discussion, hopefully, and hopefully within a period of time, since California does tend to lead the way on many things, that they will successfully get this into statute in California. And then we can say, look, they're doing it in California. And it would set the path for us. But we've already done a pretty decent job. I mean, I tell the Cody Posey story over and over again, because that's an example of a 14-year-old who all he did was kill three people in his family, his mother and father and sister. And they could not put him in adult court. He was sentenced in our juvenile system, and he was released at age 21. Now, we had a failure of our juvenile system with DMI Griego, who was sentenced, and I can't even begin to comprehend how they managed to undo his juvenile sentence, because it was so appalling to me that when he got within some number of days of reaching his 21st birthday, when he should have been released, they filed an extraordinary motion. And Ashley, if you can do a better job explaining it, but they kept Nehemiah in custody, and they resentenced him as an adult after he had been waiting to get out of prison, being sentenced under the juvenile code. How did they do that?
So essentially what they did is they went back on his behavior that was exhibited while he was in custody. And when he hit the age of majority, when they should release him, they actually found a way to keep him in and state that he was not amenable to treatment, and that if released, he was not amenable to anything that they could do after he was 21. And so it was a sleight of hand is what it really was. You rarely see it happen, but they worked night and day to keep that kid in based on his behavior while he was in custody. And I've seen that happen where what they do is a juvenile goes in on a relatively minor offense and they just keep him in until they reach either the age of majority, which normally happens at 21, or they do something like what they did with Nehemiah Griego. And Larry and I were both shaking our heads at the way they did that, because legally I've never seen that done in 25 years.
Well, I have not seen it done, and I don't think that when you're sentenced on a juvenile code, is there a clause in there? And I'm truly not in my league here, because I've never worked in this area. But is there a clause in there that allows you to reach back if the person they're supposed to be? I know the findings that they have to be amenable to, that the state has to show they're not amenable to any treatment anywhere in the state. But is there a reach back clause that if they were found amenable and they did not respond to treatment, where they can undo that decision? Is that what they did with Nehemiah?
That is what they did. It's not technically in the juvenile code. What they did is they relied on the fact that they could show that he hadn't been successful at treatment. And what they were actually going to do is bring him up on charges on stuff that occurred in the jail. And instead they used that as a kickstand to do the amenability thing. But technically amenability is supposed to happen when they're first going into the system, or you can do it at the end of when they turn 18 to see if you can keep them until they're 21. But courts lose jurisdiction pursuant to the juvenile code when they hit 21.
And that's what I thought, he should have walked free when he turned 21, but he didn't.
No, they just shifted him over to the adult system.
But anyway, we have a pretty good system all in all here in the state, and some other states out there that try very young people as adults. It's tragic because they're nowhere near ready for that. They can't even assist their attorneys in any meaningful way when you put them in adult court. The process is different in a juvenile court. Ashley, I'm sure you've been in juvenile court, but the process in terms of how a proceeding goes forward is completely different.
It's not nearly as adversarial. Adjudication. It isn't technically a prosecution. It's a petition. The parents are actually parties to the petition. There's a lot of things, and it's designed that way for a reason. It's designed to keep juveniles out of the system needlessly. So yeah, normally the judges that I've been in front of do everything they can to keep a juvenile out of the system. But having seen it, juvenile court, both in district court and also their parole hearings and everything, it's stunning to see some of the stuff that they do.
That is an excellent question.
Patron David asked for Larry's opinion, and Ashley, since you are here, obviously, we will get your take on it too. And this is a, what can you at least, like, what is this thing called?
This is the plaintiff's response to defendant's motion to dismiss. And every time you file a lawsuit challenging any aspect of state behavior, there's going to be a plethora of motions to dismiss. And this is standard procedure. They say that there's not a justiciable controversy, that there's no, that you're outside the statute of limitations, anything they can think of to say that why the case shouldn't go forward. Because if the case can't go forward, you can't win if the case is tossed on technical grounds. So this is a standard motion to dismiss. And this is the response to the state's motion to dismiss a lawsuit that was filed in Florida, which I'm not familiar with. It's a nicely done document. I went through it and highlighted some things I thought were relevant. Ashley, you can feel free to highlight more things. You should make this available in the show notes. But my reaction to it was that the attorneys did a great job, very thorough, and the judge could still dismiss it. But I would be very surprised if all these claims go down on this motion, because they were very thorough in their response, and they really called out some hypocrisy in the state on behalf of the state. What was that about the bricks and the you and I both noticed that one about the bricks.
That's my favorite quote, where they start out, they equate the registry as to a backpack, and the backpack started out relatively empty and light, and you're walking across the road, and with each step you take, they add a brick to it, so that by the time you get to the other side of the road, the backpack is completely too heavy to carry. And that's what the way that they're analogizing the registry and the way that it has just evolved since the 90s, where they just keep adding requirements and everything else. It is really, really well written. I love that quote. I'm going to find a way to use that.
And we noted some similarities between the defenses that they're asserting, that they're using the same similar defenses in our case, which these are common tactics. It's like I tell people when they're waiting trial, and they get so upset, they say, I just can't stand the stress of this anymore. And I said, well, if they can never bring you to trial, I can promise you one thing, you'll never be convicted. Well, the same operates in our side. If they can keep us from ever getting to trial, we'll never win. So that's their strategy, is to make sure we don't get our day in court.
And the famous thing about that is the finger pointing that goes on in this. And you see it anytime you have multiple agencies involved. We see it in the Illinois suit, where everybody's like, oh, it's not my job to let people out after they've done their sentence. So it's not my job to come up with a parole plan. And they just point fingers, and they're doing it in this one. They're doing it in ours. It is so common, like Larry said.
And this is in reference to like the Smith v. Doe, that the registry now is just so much very different than what was established as being the standard back then, that all of these various different things have been being challenged, being questioned as the efficacy of it all and the constitutionality. Isn't that what this sort of is hinting around?
That's the one thing I slightly disagree with these attorneys on, but it's only a slight disagreement. The efficacy, in my view, is not important. It's important to us because we know that the registry is not effective. We know that. But public policy doesn't depend on something being effective. It depends on public supporting it and it not violating the Constitution. So therefore, they were just a little more on the efficacy of registration than I would be if I were writing the brief myself. But what they did do, as they pointed out, the constant evolution and how many fundamental rights it infringes on, the right to travel and so many things here that they've thrown into this. And they've done a very good job of citing to cases around the country where the Smith versus Doe no longer applies, because registries like what existed at the time Smith versus Doe was decided virtually don't exist anywhere in the country anymore, with a couple of exceptions. And Smith versus Doe actually didn't say you can do anything you want to. And there's a quote in here. They said that Smith versus Doe doesn't say that anything you can imagine that you want to do would be constitutional. In fact, it said just the opposite. It said you can do this limited registry because it doesn't impose any disabilities or restraints. It doesn't impair your ability to travel and work where you want to. And that's so many courts have just said, oh, the state says that Smith versus Doe is controlling. We're not going to do any work. We say Smith versus Doe is controlling. The Supreme Court said registry is okay. The Supreme Court said a limited registry that Alaska had back in the 90s was okay. They didn't say all registries would be okay. And people lose sight of that. I could design a constitutional registry if I wanted to, if someone asked me to. But it would be so benign that hardly no one would appreciate having it on the people who tout the effectiveness of the registry, because for it to be constitutional, you really couldn't require anything of anybody. But just for the listeners out there, on footnote number 10, the National Association for Rational Sexual Offense Laws got cited in footnote 10 in the brief.
And what did they say? What did those crackpots say?
Well, it's a case that they cited. The National Association for Rational Sex Offenses of Sex Offense Laws et al. Versus Stein, and that's a case that they're citing. But it's a well done document. So those of you out there who like to read well done stuff, this would certainly be worth your read if you can concentrate for 27 pages.
And there's an expression you use, and you use it all the freaking time, and I can never like then regurgitate it back. It's disabilities and restraints.
Yes.
That is a very concise way of wording all of the garbage that the registry brings on you.
That is correct. And that's where the Smith versus Doe actually helps you, because you can say, actually, the Smith court didn't say you can do anything. They said you could do what Alaska was doing, precisely because it didn't impose disabilities or restraints. And there are so many disabilities or restraints on this Florida scheme. Florida thinks it's the worst in the country. Alabama thinks theirs is the worst in the country. Louisiana thinks theirs is the worst in the country. Illinois thinks theirs is the worst in the country. But they're all bad. they're all bad.
Well, cool. So I'm glad that someone pointed this out. Like I said, so this was from patron David, not using last names on purpose. But thank you for bringing it to our attention for us to give a cover.
It's a great document, and we'll see what now the state will be able to reply. They will be able to reply to this because they've made a motion. The plaintiffs have responded to the motion, and then they get to reply in support. And they'll file one more brief, and then the judge will move or rule on the motion to dismiss some or all the claims, and that's when we'll move forward.
Excellent. Ashley, so now that we're going to wrap things up, do you have any final words, comments, complaints, concerns, anything that you would like to say before we head out of here?
Larry, is there any other news? I mean, we had a busy, successful, exciting week, I think. Is there anything else we want to share?
Well, we got a busy week coming up this week. We got 237. We got 237. And you're not going to be at my side on Tuesday.
You're going to have to carry the torch without me.
And gosh, can you do that, Larry?
I won't be able to.
He will. He's a pro.
Oh. All right. Well, thank you as always, Ashley. It is always a delight and a pleasure to have you. You make it a whole lot of fun when you are here, and I greatly appreciate it.
Well, thank you. This was a really good, we had so much to discuss, and I'm looking forward to future discussions.
Cool. And Larry, as always, you are spectacular as well. And I'm going to run through the contact stuff. Follow us on Twitter, YouTube, all those places. The website is registrymatters.co. Larry, I know you love some voicemail messages, and I still haven't shut off the phone, but it's 747-227-4477. And the email address is registrymatterscast@gmail.com. And the best and our favorite way to support the podcast is at patreon.com/registrymatters. Anything else, Larry, before we go?
And how many more weeks are we going to before we disconnect the phone?
Probably infinity.
Infinity. All right.
And with that, I say goodnight to everybody, and I hope you have a great weekend, and I'll talk to you soon.
Good night.
Good night, everybody.
Night. Bye.